Good to be here. So the Berlin Patient was actually a decade or so ago, but the latest one this week is the London Patient. So yes, he is the second person with HIV who appears to have been clear of the virus after receiving a stem cell transplant. So the one thing that the two patients have in common, the Berlin patient and the London patient, is that they both had a form of blood cancer that was resistant to chemotherapy, and so both needed a bone marrow transplant, which had the useful side effect of also being able to clear them of HIV because of a certain mutation that the donors both had. So a very small number of people have two copies of a mutation in a certain gene that makes them resistant to HIV infection. It affects the receptors on the surface of white blood cells and basically prevents the virus from binding to them. So when the physicians were looking for a suitable bone marrow donor for the London patient, they also looked to see if that donor happened to have two copies of this mutation, and they found a donor that ticked the boxes. So that's part of what happened because of the bone marrow transplant. So that the idea behind that transplant was that it would basically destroy their infected white blood cells and replace them with healthy stem cells from the donor. And that appears to have been what happened, and it also had the side effect that it basically replaced their blood in a way that cleared out the virus. So I guess there's a couple of things to note there. One is that it does show that that Timothy Ray Brown, who was the Berlin patient, wasn't a one-off. So there is some potential with this treatment. The other thing to note is that it wouldn't really be suitable for most people with HIV. A bone marrow transplant is a very serious procedure, and it has far greater risk than taking the very effective HIV meds that people generally take just every day. But if the patient also happens to have leukemia or needs a transplant, then it might be logical to find a donor who has those mutations that I mentioned earlier that could also help deal with the HIV. There are 40 or so other patients who have had similar treatments from donors like these two, but they're not so far down the line yet. They're being tracked by doctors all over the world, and no doubt we'll hear more about their progress in due course. But with this London patient, it's been a good 3 or so years since he had that transplant, so the doctors and the researchers are leaving it a good amount of time before they're reporting back on how effective these treatments have been. So what these researchers have done is they've basically turned a sugar that's usually found in yeast called galactose into the THC and CBD. And one of the benefits of creating these synthetic routes to producing natural products is that you have a more reliable method and process for producing these compounds. So right now, the kind of yields that they've managed to produce from this process, which involved tweaking a bunch of genes from five different types of bacteria, the cannabis plants, they made 16 genetic tweaks to be able to transform that sugar into those cannabinoids. But the idea that they'll be able to produce it at significant quantities is a little way away for now. The research that they've reported, they produced about 8 milligrams of THC per liter, and even less for CBD. And it really needs to be maybe 100 times that to be a viable production route. So that's not something that these researchers looked at, but there is active research in all kinds of areas. I know there is, so there are some researchers, I think, in Canada that are looking to produce water-soluble cannabinoids for the beverage industry, but that's not what this particular team were looking at. Exactly. We now have super mice who can see at a wavelength that we're not able to. So mice and humans can't see in infrared, which has wavelengths that are slightly longer than red light, but though we do feel it is heat. So what these scientists did was to create nanoparticles that convert those infrared wavelengths into visible light. So in this case, they absorb the infrared and then they emit it at slightly shorter wavelengths, in this case, green light. And then they injected those nanoparticles into the eyes of mice. No, me neither. So from what they've done with the mice, they've tested it that it seemed to work. The photoreceptors in the mice, in the eyes of the mice, did respond to the infrared light and produced electrical signals, activated the visual processing areas of the brain. They did a couple of tests and it seemed to work. Of course, there are some, I suppose, possible applications in terms of military and security. But there are a couple of things that would prevent us putting this straight into humans. One of them being that the nanoparticles, as they've currently been produced, contain heavy metals, which are unlikely to be approved for use in humans. The team is actually developing organic versions to get around that. But one other potential thing to think about is that the human visual system has developed over millions of years. We've evolved to a certain point, so it's kind of difficult to know how we'd respond to suddenly being able to see in infrared. It's definitely not something that I would be keen to experiment with. There's also the potential that the same kind of mechanisms could be used or adapted to deliver drugs via this kind of mechanism as well. I think it just augments it. They did. They compared how ordinary mice behaved alongside the modified mice with a couple of trials in light and dark, and it didn't seem to affect those other things, I think, but they were focusing mainly on their ability to recognize the infrared light. Thank you so much.